Friends, let's go ahead and look at Isaiah chapter 2, and we're only going to walk through verses 1 through 5 this morning. Originally, we were going to go through verse 22, and I chose just to focus on this first portion of the passage. Let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 5 of Isaiah 2. It says, "The word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between nations. He shall decide disputes for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord.'" This is an introduction to the book of Isaiah. We had in the last chapter a thematic layout of what the book would look like, and now we have the prophet giving this very, very important prophecy regarding of what will come in the future, regarding the mountain of the Lord, the mountain of the Lord rising up and being higher than all other mountains, this great Mount Zion. We see this in verse 1, this coming from Isaiah, the son of Amoz, concerning Judah and Jerusalem. This is the word of the Lord. This is not Isaiah's opinion. This is Isaiah declaring what the Lord will do. And the purpose of this is to grant people hope for the future, grant people a hope, even though things are going to fall apart shortly after this. Uzziah, the king, is going to die. It's going to go from being a time of great economic stability, a time of great protection from their enemies, and a time in which they use that stability and protection from their enemies to sin against God in greater and greater ways. That's the consequences of sin. The consequences of sin are not solved by just a little more money. They're not solved by just a little more time. Sinful man will take even the good things from God and use them to sin in even more sophisticated ways. I mean, think of this even in light of warfare, how one country thinks, well, if we just create this particular weapon, then that'll end all war. No one will want to fight wars anymore. And yes, so long as perhaps others don't have that particular weapon, they may not. But then soon enough, as we've seen going through the 20th century, others begin to have those incredible weapons of massive, massive destruction. And it does not end those wars. You just have this dangling fear that is there at any time that if everyone launches these great weapons, they will all go off. No, the Lord is going to ultimately deal with all of these consequences of sin. And this is important for us now in this life, in this culture, and where we are, regardless of what happens, to remember that we have a hope that the Lord is going to bring all things to be a right. He's going to reconcile all things, regardless of what you may see in your life at any given point, dear Christian, regardless of what you may see in the culture at any given point. That's not your eternity. Yes, grieve such things. Yes, work to change such things, but your hope is not in the here and now. Your hope is not in that which is temporal. So we see this mountain of the Lord that will rise in the eschaton, this mountain of the Lord that will rise up and be higher than any other mountain. It's Mount Zion, and it will bring about true knowledge. This mountain will bring about true justice. And on account of that, we are encouraged to walk faithfully in the light of the Lord. This trust and hope that we have, and this promise from God that he is going to make all things right, that he is going to bring into account all things, that he is ultimately going to deal in the fullness with the consequences of sin in the time to come, and even as he is now, pointing forward to what he will ultimately do, we should walk faithfully in the light of the Lord, walking by faith, trusting in the Lord, and not trusting in our circumstances, not trusting in our situation. We see this mountain of the Lord here described in verse 2 of Isaiah 2. It says, "It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it." This is an eschatological text that is speaking of the Lord God, the covenant God of Israel, and speaking here, which many of them would have done well to pay attention to this, that is not only the God of Israel. That was a pagan idea. The pagans had the idea that a God ruled over a particular area. Remember back with the time in Exodus, when the Hebrews were in Exodus, and they said, "Let us go out into the wilderness to worship the Lord our God." And he told them, "No, you worship the Lord your God here." Well, Pharaoh believed that he was a god, and he believed that his gods ruled over Egypt. That was what he saw as what is central. And so if the Hebrews were worshiping their God in his land, he saw that as ultimately being worshiped to him and his God, because he ruled over that area. And were they to go out into the wilderness outside of Pharaoh's dominion, then he didn't see himself as receiving that worship. He didn't see these Egyptian gods as receiving that worship. It was beyond his authority. This is a pagan view of a deity that is bound to a particular land area. Not so with the true God. Not so with the Lord who made the heavens and the earth. He is one, and he says here, who will bring all nations to himself. This is an eschatological text. This is talking of the latter days, the future that will happen, what the Lord will bring about. And we see this coming to pass, beginning with Christ and his incarnation and all the work that he will do, and then what follows through his life, his death, his resurrection, the Spirit going forward into the church. We see this beginning to work itself out. That's the idea that we have when Paul talks about the Spirit being a down payment. All right? It's an earnest payment. Like those of you that have bought houses and you had to make an earnest payment. It's an earnest payment on what is going to come. This is what he is doing now. He's accomplishing his purpose in his people now through his word and through his Spirit. But he is going to bring all things to pass. He's going to accomplish the fullness of what he has sought out to do. He's going to defeat sin and death completely and ultimately. Sin will no longer affect you in those times. No longer will unrighteous rulers have opportunity to persecute the church. The Lord will bring his will to pass at that time, and it will be no more. This mountain that rises up is this Mount Zion. It's the mountain or hill, depending on how you want to define it, mountain or hill, upon which Jerusalem is sitting. It's the place upon which the temple was built. And soon enough, it's going to be ransacked by enemies. Here is Isaiah talking of the mountain of the Lord, talking about Zion and how it's going to be high and lifted up, and all of the nations are going to come to Zion, and very shortly, the enemies of Israel are going to come in and they are going to ransack everything. They are going to go into the northern kingdom and they are going to take people into exile. They are ultimately going to go into the southern kingdom and they are going to take people into exile. But Isaiah is giving this to them that they may remember that the Lord is going to bring all things under his feet, that the Lord is going to accomplish his good purpose, that the Lord is ultimately going to raise Zion up higher than all other mountains. And he will do that through the one who is to come, through the Lord Jesus Christ. The second Adam, the first Adam, you remember, was there in that tabernacle of Eden, there with Eve, dwelling with God, perfect harmony, walking in righteousness until they were not walking in righteousness, and they were removed, breaking that covenant of works. And so like Adam, you had Israel being placed in the promised land, granted this land, being placed under a covenant of works. So long as they kept that covenant, so long as they were obedient to that Mosaic covenant, they would stay in that land. As I said earlier, they used the blessings the Lord gave them to sin against him even more. They violated the covenant. They have broken this covenant, and Isaiah brought charges before them in the last chapter. He came before them as a covenantal prosecutor, calling witnesses even of creation, calling witnesses of the sun and the moon and the mountains, and say, look at these people and how they have broken the covenant that they were under, the covenant that they had made with their God who had blessed them, called them out of slavery to walk and to worship him in obedience. So in Adam, there was failure, and likewise, in Israel, there was failure. They will fail. They will be removed, even being removed east, being removed east, just as Adam and Eve were taken out the eastern gate of the garden. See, but Christ will come. Christ, that second Adam, that better Adam, Christ will come, and Christ will walk in faithfulness. Like Adam, when Satan came and temptation came, it was disobedience. There was a turning away from what is right. All of the garden was there for them to eat from, and yet this one fruit they coveted. Christ, the greater Israel. Christ, the greater Israel. That don't you know that that is what Matthew speaks of when he says, out of Israel I will call my son. And he's quoting, I think, from Hosea. So what is he talking about? He's saying that Jesus is the greater Israel. He is the one that will be faithful. Israel was under that covenant of works and they broke it and they would be removed. They would not be the one who would draw all people to themselves. They were called to do that. Israel was called to be the light of the world. I say that. You say, no, what? Jesus is the light of the world. He is the light of the world. But Israel was called to be the light of the world. We see that, I believe, in Isaiah even. They were called to be the light of the world. They were not the light of the world. They broke that covenant, but one would come. One would come and walk in faithfulness. Christ would establish this mountain. The mountains of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest mountain, shall be lifted up above all of the other hills. Zion wasn't the highest hill, wasn't the highest mountain. There are others around that are higher. You remember in the Old Testament, oftentimes they would walk through the various kings and they would. It's interesting, isn't it, when you read the Old Testament, and they don't always tell you specifically all the things that they had done. They just list out the things that they are doing. And you need to know the Torah. You need to know the Pentateuch to know what it is that they're violating and what they should have been doing. You're saying, this is a good king, and he did this good thing and that good thing and that. But he didn't take down the high places. You remember that over and over and over. Finally, we do get a king that takes down those high places. But for generations, you see this Even the better kings didn't take down these high places. And the pagans would go up to these high places because they believed the higher that they would get, the closer they were to God, that they, through their efforts of walking up these mountains and establishing these temples in these certain specific places, that they were granting themselves greater access to God than other people that were, I don't know, further down the hill might have. And so they went to these higher places because Zion wasn't the highest place. Jerusalem wasn't the high, it was high. It was an excellent position for a city to be in. David established a city there because they could protect themselves very well from those that might ever seek to go after them. But it wasn't the highest area. The Samaritans would establish a temple in Mount Gerizim. Remember that? That's higher than the Temple Mount on Jerusalem. They established one there because they had a syncretistic religion. They took aspects of paganism and they took aspects of the Pentateuch and they mixed them together and made their amalgamation of a religion. Remember, it will be the Samaritans that will come about as the northern and southern kingdom are exiled. There will be those Jews that are left at that time. They won't remove everyone. They will keep some there. And then they will take people from another area. And I don't know where they came from, but they take people from another area. This is a very common thing for these empires to do when they would take over an area. They would take the original people out, leave a few, and then take some others from another nation state and put them in there. That's where we got the Samaritans, at least that's where we believe we got the Samaritans, and they would worship in this higher place called Mount Gerizim. And this led to a lot of tension once the southern kingdom was reestablished, because now you had this competing temple in Samaria. Again, Mount Ebal is another nearby mountain. It's higher than Zion. I think it's higher than any of them. We could even look to another great mountain, Everest. It's enormous, much, much higher than the Temple Mount. But this text says that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains. It shall be lifted up above the hills. This isn't talking about, I'm sure you see that by now, this isn't talking about just raising up rocks and making them really, really high so that, you know, you're going to end up with something that's higher than Mount Everest, and it's going to be really, really cold up there, and it's going to be really, really difficult to climb up there. And if that did happen, people would be trying to climb that mountain. I'm sure that's what we do when we see very tall objects. We try to climb them. I don't, but other people that like to climb things will do that. But this is talking about this is spiritual. It's talking about the mountain of the Lord, the greatness of the religion that the true God offers, the only true religion that is there. It will be raised up. It doesn't always look that way, though. Remember the people group that we prayed for today. They were 0.15 of 1%. That's what they were. And 38, 39 million Muslims within that people group, they don't look like they are powerful. They don't look like they are of the highest of the mountains. They look quite feeble. They don't look very great at all. Think of even the Jews and the Lord calling them out of Egypt. They weren't great and powerful, and neither did the Lord call them for that purpose. But that's the distinction between true and false religion. There's two religions. We could, if we want to use this analogy we have here within this text, there are two mountains that you can worship on. There's true religion and there is false religion. There is the false religion that grants man a means whereby he can establish and grow his relationship with God through his own efforts, through his own deeds. He can merit himself a righteousness. It was possible to do that at one time. It's not completely wrong to say that one could gain something from God through righteous actions. If Adam had been faithful, if he had not sinned, if he had been obedient in the garden, he would have received the reward for righteous living. That's what would have happened. Well, how do we know that? Because that's what Jesus did on our behalf, and he is the second Adam. These things are important. That's why we read the book years back called Getting the Garden Right. If you mess up on the garden, then you're going to mess up other things going further on. Think of that like when you're building something. You know, it's one thing if you mess up something higher up. It's not good to mess anything up, but there's been times when I'm working on something and maybe it's tile and I get a little higher up, but it's like 32nd of an inch off, 16th of an inch. It's not that big of a deal. A little bit of trim, a little bit of molding, but if I'm down at the bottom of this tile wall that I was building a little, and I started getting off, it got out of plumb. That's how vertical it is. It got out of plumb. And I realized by the time I got to the top, I was gonna have a 2-inch gap on one side. I was gonna need to cut a whole other piece of tile to go. It was gonna look ridiculous. I had to stop. I had to fix that. Things that are foundational affect things that are on the top. Have you ever had a problem with your foundation at your house? A little problem in the foundation at your house, just a couple degrees off, and now what's happening? You got cracks in your walls, you got things happening on your roof. Foundational aspects of religion are crucial, and the garden speaks of these things, and the garden informs us why it is that it is false religion to claim that you can attain a righteousness before God through your own efforts. Why? Because that was damaged in the fall. You can't keep the law. You can keep your standard of the law. You can keep this idea that you've created, where you compare yourself with others, but you can't keep the law of God. You're unable to do it. God's going to judge you not only on your deeds, which you fall short on, but also in your desires, the intentions of your heart. We can't do it. That's why all religion, which is works-based based upon you doing these religious actions, you giving these particular sacrifices, is false. But these religions put up incredible buildings. These religions are extremely wealthy. You look at the Mormon church, they are dripping in wealth. You can look at a bizarre cult like Scientology, really bizarre. They are extremely wealthy. They have a significant amount of influence, maybe not as much as they make themselves out to have. You can look at Islam and its overwhelming influence. You can look at something like the false religion of Roman Catholicism in the land, in the wealth, in the gold that they have, and they look as though they are like a ruler sitting upon the hill at this time. But it is not so in the time to come. It is not so in the time to come. The Lord is going to bring all things to account. The mountain of the Lord will be raised. It will just be a difference of perspective. The Lord is going to bring all things to an account. Then we're going to see here the effects of the mountain of the Lord. We see that in verses 3 and 4 of Isaiah chapter 2. He says, "And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of God, the house of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between nations and decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation shall not lift up sword against nation, and neither shall they learn war anymore." The Lord is going to bring creation back into harmony. How so? By raising the mountain of the Lord through the work of the Messiah. That's how it's going to begin, through the work of Christ and what he is going to do in establishing and setting forth that true mountain of true religion that is there, that puts before you the fullness of the law. You see that communicated in this passage. The law will be taught rightly on this mountain. And that is what is done in true religion. The law is communicated. The law is communicated rightly so that when you hear the law, you say, I got this. I'm good with that. You'll say, at least I'm not like this person or that person. You say, woe is me, like Isaiah is going to say here in a few chapters. Woe is me, for I live amongst the people of unclean lips. and I'm a man of unclean lips. You look upon the law of God, and it is like a mirror. The law serves three purposes, Reformed friends. The law serves three purposes. There are those that like to say, well, the law doesn't really serve any purpose for the Christian. We have the law of Christ. What is that law? Well, it's how the Christian should live. It's even greater than the laws that they had in the Old Testament. Oh, okay. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. How about that law? You got that one? You're doing well with that one? That's a summary of the first four commandments. Check. I don't think so. Love your neighbor as yourself. Always do that? You always follow those last six commandments? No, you don't. The law serves to stand before us as a mirror. It's a mirror. You look in the mirror. Like I might look in the mirror and I see something on my face. I'm like, oh no. It's not the mirror's fault. It's just revealing. It's telling me what's there. And I look into the true law of God, and I see that I don't keep this, that I don't meet this standard. It shows us our need for a Savior. Sometimes pain isn't fun, right? If you touch a stove, it's hot. You don't like that. But it serves a good purpose. It tells you that's hot. It's going to hurt you. You look into the law of God, and you see that it's painful to see the ways in which you fall short. It's painful so long as you are trusting in your own efforts, so long as you are standing upon the mountain of man, that false religion, and trying to attain for yourself a righteousness through your own efforts. See, but who can but approach the mountain of the Lord? It's the one who has clean hands, one who has a clean heart. That is Christ. That is Christ alone. And he grants that to his people. He grants to his people his righteousness. That's the blessing. That is the goodness of seeing that law, and that law that is taught first and foremost when someone sees their need of Christ. That law that is taught within the church. That law that will be taught throughout eternity to the people of God, where we will grow in a greater understanding of who God is, and we will grow in a greater understanding even of the depths from which we have been pulled, ways in which God's grace has been shown to us. We have been lavished in his grace that we don't even realize right now. That law serves as a mirror. That's not all it serves. It serves as the best way for people in the culture to live. It's the best way that you could live is in accordance with God's law. This is the best way the Christian can live. The law of Christ is the moral law of God. This isn't some different higher law. Like it's to be obedient to God in the moral law within your desires, within your thoughts, within your actions. I don't know how you're getting higher than that. I think that is pretty difficult as it is, especially even as those who are being sanctified. This is something that we're continuing to grow in. Not until we are glorified will this no longer be an issue for us. The Lord's bringing creation back into harmony. Remember, at the fall, the creation was cursed. Paul talks even as the creation groaning for this time when Christ is going to come back and bring all things to pass. God's law is going to be taught and practiced in true knowledge at this time. We see that there in verse 3. Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the Lord of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his path. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. This is looking forward to that new Jerusalem. We have that spoken of in the book of Revelation. It's really important. It's hard to really understand the book of Revelation if you don't understand the Old Testament. There are themes flowing throughout Revelation that necessitate that you understand the themes that flow through the Old Testament. But God is here reestablishing this tabernacle with man, reestablishing this Edenic temple, this temple of Eden with man, this which is being established in Christ, the one who came down and tabernacled with us. Because sin affected man and his understanding of the law, of the word. It created this separation between man and God, but Christ reestablished that and is growing us in this and will ultimately glorify his church. 2 Peter 3 and verse 18. But grow in the grace and knowledge of the Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. To him be the glory both now and to the day of eternity. This is but a foretaste of eternity, even what the Lord is granting to you now. And hearing the word and singing praises to God and the sanctification that he is doing even in your life is a preparation for that ultimate glorification that he will accomplish in the eschaton. In this mountain, there will be true teaching of God's law, true understanding of God's law, and there will also be true justice. True justice will come forth at this time. Isaiah 2 and verse 4, he shall judge between the nations and shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. You know, there's a few passages in the Bible that political leaders really like to quote. And especially the further they get to the left into socialism, the more they like to quote those particular verses. And this is one in particular. I don't know if Romans 13 or Isaiah 2 is more popular for people to quote when they are seeking to be dictatorial and tyrannical in their ruling over a people. But I want you to pay attention to this passage. It does not say that the Lord is going to establish rulers that do not even acknowledge him and remove the people's swords through buyback programs and through confiscation. That's not what this says. It says they will beat their swords into plowshares. This is the time when the Lord is going to fully establish justice. These things won't be necessary anymore. There's a long history of weapons being necessary. There's a reason why people carry guns, people have knives, people have had swords throughout history, because there is evil that people are fighting against. And some of the reality is you have evil people that are seeking to use those weapons against you, to take advantage of you. And that's why people arm themselves with these weapons. It's not about the weapon itself being in and of itself wrong. It's a tool. Tools have purposes. Is there something wrong with a hammer? No, but you can do something evil with a hammer. You can hurt someone. You can commit a crime with a hammer. You can also build a house. It can be used either way. It's just a tool. But we see this history of just evil within the scriptures. We see that right before the flood, Genesis 6 and verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intention and thought of his heart was only evil continually. And the flood came after that. We remember at the end of Judges, an incredible line at the end of Judges. You know, it really is a fantastic book, oftentimes used in children's stories. Maybe they don't use some of the stories in Judges in those children's stories. But there's really some fantastic things in that book. But it ends with this line that we see flowing throughout that book. It says, in those days there was no king, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Is that not the problem of man? Doing what is right in his own eyes, not looking to God's law, not taking into account the judgment to come. Notice this, that prior to the beating of the swords into plowshares, he says, he will judge between nations and shall decide disputes for the people. The Lord is establishing his rule amongst the people. There's no longer going to be a need for these weapons intended for destruction. They don't serve a purpose anymore. It's not something that rulers, and certainly not rulers that deny God, have any business using a passage like this to try to use this to disarm people, to take away their guns. I think swords are cool, especially Japanese katanas. Those are neat. Guns are nice. I like guns. Some of you like guns a whole lot more than I do. Some of you have a lot of guns. Some of you have let's be honest, you have a lot of ammo. And that's fine. These are tools. You can have these things. It's not wrong to own these things. But this is not about a time where a governing leader is coming in and confiscating these things. Isn't that interesting? These dictatorial rulers that come into power, that's one of the first things that they seek to remove from the population. It's one of the first things. They will come in and try to take away weapons that people can use to defend themselves. And it does two things. It creates chaos in the culture, whereby you have people that followed the rules and gave back their guns, and other people that didn't follow the rules that can then rule over them. And it also gives the leadership power to squash any rebellion or lack of obedience from the people that are there. It's not what this passage is talking about. Removing weapons by misquoting verses is not what this is about. This is about a time when there will no longer be a need of weapons. And the right has an issue with this too, that I could say. I mean, I made a joke that some of you have a lot of weapons, and that's fine to have a lot of guns, to have a lot of weapons, but we also are not bringing these things to pass by just amassing larger amounts of weapons and having larger stockpiles. If you want to have that for fun, that's fine, but that's not how we're going to, you know, bring the will of God to pass in this life. It's sometimes got conservative friends and they begin to talk about this, or if only we had more people with more guns, if more people just were carrying more guns. No, that's not going to solve the issue either. Not in either way. Taking away everyone's guns isn't going to solve it. It's going to create problems. Just everyone having even more guns isn't necessarily going to solve it either, and that's realistically going to create some more problems as well. This is not about taking people's guns away. This is about the Lord establishing true justice, that there's no longer a need for anyone to protect themselves. Jesus, who told the disciples, if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak. There's robbers. You would need one to out there. You may need to defend yourself. He didn't tell them you're going to need to get 50 swords, but he said, you take a sword with you. You may need a sword. There's the time and a purpose for that. At this time, you will no longer have a need for any kind of weapons. This is harkening to a time where will be true justice, where God will so rule in the heart of man that there will be no need for such weapons. The unrighteous will fall under the judgment of God. The righteous will be glorified and will walk in obedience to God's law. Evil will be vanquished. And hear this. This is what I want you to hear, is that there is an eschatological hope that we have in the establishment of ultimate justice. It is very important that you see that. That is causing many people great problems within this culture right now. That there is no longer a trust that there is going to be an ultimate justice. That there's going to be a final judgment where God is going to bring into account all that is evil, that everything is going to be put in order, that someone may in this life get away with some evil. Someone may amass billions of dollars living their lives in evil, taking advantage of others, hiding things that are true, that they know to be true, that they may amass greater wealth, that they may oppress people. You're not hiding it from everyone. The Lord knows. The Lord knows all things. Man can look over his left shoulder, look over his right shoulder. Man can go in and delete his history and his internet. Man can go in and erase these bank records, but not from the mind of God. God knows all. You're not hiding anything from God. You're not pulling one over on him. He's going to bring all things to account. And such an understanding of a judgment to come is beneficial even for the person who's not in Christ. That is a curb to evil, just a recognition that we're going to give an account for what we do. We're living in a time where this is being forgotten. This is being completely dismissed. Man has desired to take off the shackles of true religion, so he believes they are, but rather he's putting on the shackles of legalistic religion. He thinks he's taking off one, but he's really not. He's shackling himself. And he's placing himself in a position where there is no judgment to come. He's seeking to free himself from this judgment to come. And now he lives in the world where he sees all of this evil and there's no solution for it. How many times do you hear people use such an argument? They say, how can there be a God when there's so much evil in the world? Well, if there is a God, you know that he's going to deal with that. He is dealing with it. He's ultimately going to deal with it. But the one who dismisses God's existence, who tries to live as though there is no God, brings about within his heart and his mind great frustration and anxiety, because there is a hope that you have in the fact that the Lord will establish ultimate justice. The fact that ultimate justice is going to be established is something that you can trust in. You don't have to work it all out here. You don't have to be the one who's working out providence for God. You don't have to be the one who is making sure everything ends up just right, that all the I's are dotted, that all the T's are crossed. There's great angst and anxiety that's going to reside in the heart of the one who denies this time of future justice. Think about that. What are the consequences when you deny the final judgment? When you deny the fact that the Lord is going to reconcile all things? When even what you walk through as a Christian, that you know that, oh, this is even working for my good. I don't understand how. But I can see in the past where it worked out for other people's good. I can see how Joseph got sold into slavery, and the Lord meant that for good, though his brothers meant it for evil. I can see that, and I can, in my situation, then trust that I have a hope even here, that God's going to accomplish his good purpose here. I just need to walk in faithfulness. The last judgment gives us an eschatological comfort that he's going to set all things right. And what is happening now with people? There is great stress that people are going through. They are seeing evils that happened in the past. They're true evils. And the people that committed them aren't even alive anymore. But yet we need to reconcile this. We need to make all of these things right so that this evil is dealt with over here. They end up creating a greater form of injustice in the pursuit of trying to deal with this justice over here. But what's at the foundation? What's at the heart of it? There's no trust in the judgment to come. There's no trust that God is going to deal with this. God is going to make all of these things right. The concern is that I must do this right now. There was a concern that came out at Harvard many years ago, and it was one where some of the male students were being accused of abuse by some of the female students. And they began to bring this forward, and law enforcement would work through it. And in some of the cases, they would find evidence, and the person would be prosecuted and charged, and it would go through the system. And then in other cases, there would not be sufficient evidence for the charge that was being brought forward. And the concern got brought up, but wait a second, this isn't acceptable. There's not always going to be evidence for something like this. So merely on the accusation, the person needs to be charged and the person needs to be put into prison merely on account of this outcry that's been given by this person. And the argument that was given by someone who was educated, I think they had a PhD, is that, look, there's many times in the past where men have been abusive to women and they have gotten away with it. And so what does it matter here if some of these innocent men get accused and go to prison, because there's many in the past that had not. That person wasn't, I don't think, thinking about their own child or themselves that was being falsely accused and taken into prison when they were innocent. But again, what is at the foundation of such anxiety, such concern? It's that there's not going to be one who will reconcile all things. There will not be a last judgment. There will not be a God who will bring all things to account. But you don't have to have such anxiety. You don't have to have such fear. You work towards justice in this life. You work towards righteousness here, knowing that even in our system, as good as it is and how it was established, I believe, that you still have to deal with reasonable doubt. You still have to deal with men and women who are sitting and making such decisions based upon what they know. But we know that ultimately, you're not going to hide from God. No, you're not going to hide from God. God is going to bring all things aright. And therefore, we have this great application. The Lord is going to raise up this mountain. This mountain is going to arise higher than all of the other mountains. Mount Zion is going to rise. The Lord is going to offer true education, true teaching of his law. Men will rightly see who they are and see the grace that has been given to them through the promised one to come. Justice will be established perfectly, such that the weapons that are used even now will no longer need to be necessary. All things are going to be made right. And the application that is given at this point is, O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. That you can rest in this knowledge, that even though the enemies will come in shortly, and they will need to remember what Isaiah is saying here. The enemies will come in and they will be removed. They will no longer even be on Mount Zion. They will no longer be in Jerusalem. They will be out of this vicinity. They will be taken into the east. And they will be ruled over by pagans that do not recognize or serve the God that took the Israelites out of Egypt. But yet they must remember that though they stand not on this mountain, that the Lord will raise up this mountain, that those who are in him are being fed even now through this mountain, through this great religion that the Lord gives to us. And the same for us, dear friends. We live in times that they can be very frustrating politically. Even in the last few weeks, there's been great disappointment that I've seen from both sides. We've got this two-party system. Both sides are saying some terrible things. Both sides are saying some things that are unrighteous, that are not even recognized the dignity of humanity. There's even the so-called conservatives are throwing things out and saying, you know what, abortion at 6 weeks, that is too strict. That needs to be moved. That's what you have running for the Republican Party right now. That's too strict. Arguing that even in vitro fertilization should be subsidized by insurance companies and the government. We have many things that we can look about and we can say, this is unrighteous. This is wrong. And yet our hope is not in such men or women in this case as well. Our hope is not in these rulers. We must pray for them. We must work for righteousness. We must work for justice. But our hope is in the Lord. Our hope is in this mountain that the Lord will establish and is establishing. It's there with Christ. He has been granted to us, working with us in us even now. That new creation. The Lord's going to make a new heavens and new earth. And he's beginning inside of you, dear Christian. He's beginning in your heart and giving you life and sanctifying you. That's where this is beginning. Regardless of what we see around us, regardless of what happens within this culture, our hope is not there, though we care. But our hope is not in this culture, but it is in the Lord, who has established his mountain and will bring to pass at his time a time where all the nations will be gathered to himself, people from every tongue, tribe, and nation, and the law will be declared and it will be understood. And people will say, come to the Lord, come and hear from the Lord, and the evil will be vanquished. Dear church, trust in this message. Trust in this promise that we have from the Lord, that he will make all things right. And regardless of what you see, at any point in your life, you can remember that's not your eternity. that the Lord has purchased for you an eternity that will be free from sin, a time where there will no longer be sadness or violence or corruption or theft or lies. This will be removed. Press on, dear church, and trust in Christ. Trust in what he has established, what he is establishing. And trust in what he has established for you for all eternity.